Okay. So let us get started. Let's see what this what we have here. Can you speak a bit more about the importance of confidence? How do I gain confidence in my practice? Okay, so confidence is really, it really what it is about is confidence in the teachings of the Buddha. That's really what it comes back to, having faith, having a feeling that these teachings actually work, that they are what they are supposed to, what they say they are. And really what I would just suggest that you do is continue to investigate those teachings and to see if they actually work in your ordinary life and see if they give the results that they're supposed to do. And usually you can start off with very simple things. And one of the things that the Buddha says is that any kind of practice that is done in the right way, it should give some kind of happiness in your life. You should start to feel better about yourself. And very simple things like, what does it feel like to be live well, to live a life with a good heart, to live a life of virtue, to live a life of kindness and compassion and generosity, and try to feel what it feels like. And the Buddha says quite clearly that if you live your life well, you tend to feel a degree of happiness because of that. This is kind of the most foundational and basic happiness on the path. And in this way, you start to gain confidence in these teachings. Perhaps what you mean here is confidence in your meditation practice. Maybe this is what you are referring to specifically. Very often you can't really, I think, distinguish between meditation and the path as a whole. All of these things come together. So it's really about having confidence in the whole path. And if you see that the Buddha is right about kindness that gives rise to happiness, then you know that very likely he will be right about other things on the path too. You see certain things that make sense, and things tend to go together. So it's just a matter of keeping at it, keeping doing the right thing, living in the right way. And as you do that, it will give the results that that must come from meditation practice eventually. One of the problems is that people are so different. Some people are, because they have maybe lived well in the past life, or they have lived well earlier in this life, or whatever it is, the mind is ready to experience meditation. The mind is peaceful enough to actually give rise to the joy and the happiness and all the positive benefits of meditation practice. For some people, it takes much longer. It's much more difficult. You need to build up all the basic qualities first of all. And then when the basic qualities are built up, then the meditation will start to come together. It's all a matter of where you are at in your practice. Meditation is not something that will always give results. Some people, if they have lived perhaps in the wrong way, they can have meditation can be terrible. Some people hate meditation because it just gives rise to problems and anxieties and all kinds of things. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. That just means that you have to start somewhere else with your practice. You have to start with the more basic factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So if you're having problems with your meditation, go back to your conduct. Go back to the basic things and build them up more. And as you build them up more, you will notice if you go on regular meditation retreats, maybe once a year or however often it is, you will notice that from one year to the next one, there will be some kind of improvement there. Your mindfulness is better. Your ability to stay with the breath improves. It may not be spectacular. There may be nothing really amazing, but it's better than it was the year before. And as long as it is getting better, it doesn't matter where it is, but what matters is that it's getting better. And if it is getting better, you're on the right path and you're heading in the right direction. That's what you should be looking at. You shouldn't be looking at some absolute result, but whether you're actually making improvements. That is what is important. So think in terms of the whole path, think in terms of all of the factors, and look at the long term, whether it is working for you, and then you hopefully will find a way of making this work. Okay, how to teach the mind to focus on the breath? It keeps wandering around. Indeed. So, and that is one of the kind of main problems in meditation practice, the mind wandering around, the mind being slothful. Very often it tends to go either one way or the other. Either it's tired or it wanders around and it's kind of restless. This is the two problems of meditation. And the reason why that is happening is because you are finding some kind of happiness and joy in the mind wandering around. Yeah, so what you have to do is you have to, there's two things you can do. One of them is you have to understand that all that wandering is not going to be very helpful. The reason why you wander is because you think there's some important business there. That's one reason. And the other one is because you're just not really happy in the present moment. So the mind prefers to wander around. So the answer is to enjoy the meditation practice. And this is one of the reasons why I don't recommend people, especially in the beginning, to feel too much pain and discomfort. Because basically it's going to create even more of a wandering mind. Because the mind doesn't want to be here, it's going to be even more problematic. So the idea is to enjoy what you have. Yeah, enjoy what is there, enjoy the peace. And if you don't enjoy, get up, do some walking around in the beautiful bush around here. It's an amazing autumn day that we're having. It's just so beautiful out there. Have a cup of tea, lie down a little bit, do whatever it takes to kind of get back into track and to enjoy what is going on. And then as you enjoy it, the mind is going to wander less. The other thing is to come back to some of the instructions I gave on the first night. Yeah, that's yesterday only. Okay, seems like a long time already. That was only yesterday. And I was the idea of giving priority to your spiritual life, knowing what really matters in the world, understanding that the world outside is always going to be so unreliable. This is what the idea of anicca, impermanence, really is. It's the idea of unreliability, uncertainty, the idea that you can't control it. Everything in the world, eventually you're going to have to give everything up, because at the very latest when you die, everything is going to have to go. But even long before that, things are going to be impermanent, things are going to change, things are going to let you down. Before you know it, you're going to have some kind of trauma in your life. It's just the way it has to be. It can't be any other way. And once you, the more you understand the unreliability of that world outside, the less interested you become in it. And the more you come to the meditation practice as a true refuge. This is where things really happen. This is actually what is really interesting. This is where you can find real profundity and meaning in life. So turn your attention to that which really matters in the world, and let go of all the stuff that ultimately is just going to lead to more problems and is always going to let you down anyway. So prioritize the spiritual path. It doesn't mean that all the other things in life are completely meaningless, but it means that you deal with them in a different way. You deal with them from a different set of ideas, and that is kind of what it is about. So this is how it works, and ultimately, in the end, if you start to get some joy coming up in your meditation practice, not everybody does that. Usually, it's hard to say how many, but there are always a number of people who do, but many people don't, because it takes a lot of practice for the mind to actually experience that spiritual joy. But that becomes the glue, ultimately, that keeps you on the breath. Once the breath appears joyful, and the breath appears delightful or whatever, it's very easy to stay with the breath, because it's just so natural, it's so nice. You don't want to be anywhere else. You don't want to wander around. You want to be with what is nice. So that is kind of one of the tricks, is to find that beauty in the breath. So see the breath as a friend. See the breath as something that has always been there to sustain your life. Have maybe even a bit of gratitude to your breath. Yeah. And once you see your breath in a positive way, rather than in a way that is as something negative, because it's also easy to build up negativity towards the breath. If you don't enjoy it and it becomes tense or whatever, you can give rise to negativity. And that is also going to be very difficult and going to make it very hard to do your meditation practice. So see the beauty in the breath. See your breath as a friend. Yeah, a beautiful friend that you're walking with into meditation practice. This is one of the skillful techniques to use. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, I find it difficult to concentrate on a single mode of meditation, Samatha Vipassana Metta, when doing meditation for a long time. Is it all right to mix them in one session? Much merit to you for your valuable Dhamma Dana. It is okay. You can do that. But make sure that you don't mix too much. Because if you mix too much, it's often just the restless mind moving around. You can't really stay with one thing. But you can mix a little bit, absolutely. And you can, for example, do a bit of metta in the beginning, if you like, just to get the mind in a positive state. So the mind has, you get rid of any kind of maybe residual negativity or whatever that is there. And if you have that metta and then you go on to the breath later on, you may find that actually becomes so much easier to follow the breath. And the breath becomes, the meditation becomes far more powerful, and it takes you to a much deeper state. Mix, but be careful not to mix just randomly. Mix according to some kind of plan, and not just according to restlessness or whatever, but according to some kind of system that works for you. And that is really what matters. And then ask yourself what the results are. Everything in meditation should really be measured by the results. So how do you feel when you come out of the meditation compared to when you started? And if you feel more relaxed, at ease, peaceful, and all of these kind of things, then you know that you're heading in the right direction. If you have more clarity of mind, that's how I like to translate Vipassana, like as clear seeing. I think that's really what it means in the suttas. You see things clearly, and you see things clearly when the mind becomes peaceful and calm. You see more clearly. Vipassana and Samatha always going together in this way. So look at that, look at the result. If the result is good, then what you're doing is probably right. Dear Ajahn, if we don't believe in the Abhidhamma, are we then not Theravada? That's a very good question. Maybe we have to check out Theravada. Maybe we can, if we leave the Abhidhamma to one side, maybe we're not Theravadins anymore. Is that bad not to be Theravadin? It depends what we mean by these things. And this is kind of the thing here. And you don't really, it's not about not believing or believing in the Abhidhamma so much. People sometimes read the Abhidhamma, sometimes they may get something out of that. It's more about having your priorities right, knowing where your main emphasis should be. And the emphasis should always be on the suttas. That should be the gold standard for what we take to be the Dhamma. And you can read a bit of Abhidhamma if you like, and maybe you may find, some people find it, inspiring. Personally, I find it very dry and very, very uninspiring personally. But maybe you can gain some insight and some understanding from reading that. I don't really know. But the main point is that you come back to the suttas. And if you have any doubt about whether the Abhidhamma is right or the suttas are right, stick with the suttas. That is where the real Dhamma is to be found. I would personally recommend you to put the Abhidhamma aside altogether. And the reason is because there's plenty enough study to be done in the suttas. You can read the suttas. And once you have finished all the suttas, it's about 5,000 pages. And for most of you, you're already probably quite busy. Many of you already have very busy lives. It takes a while to get through 5,000 pages. It's not done in one sitting. If you do, you're going to be very tired after that one sitting. So it's not easy. And then when you come to the end of 5,000, you've forgotten where you started. So you go back to the beginning again. Start from page one and then go again. And then you can kind of go like that. So there's no time to read Abhidhamma. If you read the suttas properly, not enough time. And if you read the Abhidhamma, all it's going to do is going to prolong your stay in samsara, because of too much reading. And too much reading kind of prolongs our things. Let's put it to one side. And allow it to be. There's no real reason to go there unless you have some very good reason for doing it. So that's what I would recommend. Does that mean we are not Theravadin? There's many different kind ways of being Theravadin. There are the Theravadins who say that the Abhidhamma is a more fundamental teaching than the suttas. Well, you're not going to be that kind of Theravadin. That's obvious. I think we have Theravadin is a big school. It's very wide. There's a lot of room for different kind of opinions there. And I think you can still call yourself Theravadin if you take the Pali Sutras as your main theme to of study. I think you can still call yourself Theravadin if you want to. But you don't have to call yourself Theravadin. It doesn't really matter. It's much better to just call yourself a disciple of the Buddha, rather than tying yourself down to one particular school. That's what I like to think. So then what that means is that you take the suttas, the early suttas, and you try to find the common denominator between the various versions of the suttas that we have, and you take that as your teacher. You don't have to be any particular school. You're just a straight disciple of the Buddha. That's quite inspiring, isn't it? Be a disciple of the Buddha, rather than being disciple of all these other teachers who came a long time afterwards, whoever they may be. I find that's quite nice. Whatever you call yourself doesn't really matter. What matters is where you find your inspiration. Dear Ajahn, you talked about the type of personality a noble one has. In the Majjhima Nikaya, page 190 of the latest edition, I think, in the Sevitabha Sutta, I think Bhikkhu Bodhi translates, and writes about good bad acquisition of individuality. Is this referring to acquisition of positive personality for practice? Good and bad acquisition of individuality. Does he mention that in that sutta? I can't remember. Maybe he does. I'm going to have to check it up because I can't remember that actually off the top of my head. So I will look it up and I will come back to your question tomorrow. That's service for you. We'll do it properly. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I've read that the Buddha mentioned that the fourfold Sangha consists of bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, Buddhist laymen and Buddhist laywomen. Why is it that laymen and laywomen are considered Sangha? They are not considered Sangha. The idea that laymen and laywomen are considered Sangha is a modern kind of idea. And I think it probably started in the United States, because in the United States they didn't have any monks and nuns. So they called the lay people Sangha instead. It's like feel good. Yeah, we're all Sangha. We're all kind of hanging out together, all kind of practicing together. But there's always a bit of a danger in that, because it means that redefine the language, and it means that sometimes it has unintended consequences when you do that. I am not sure if I really think that's such a good idea to call. It's better to kind of use the same language we find in the suttas, because then it's easier to relate to the suttas and understand what is going on. But to me, Sangha means monastic Sangha. In modern Western world, you have to put the word monastic in front to understand that actually Sangha is meant the monks and nuns, not just anybody. So it really goes against how it is written in the suttas, and I think that is a little bit unfortunate sometimes. What's the difference between Sangha and monastic? It's the same thing. Sangha is just a group, and the monastic is an individual. So the Sangha is a group of monastics. Usually four or more monastics is a Sangha. If it is between one and four, it is called a Gana, which means a group. A Sangha is like a larger group. Are Samaneras and Samaneris Sangha or monastic or both? Thank you. Are they Sangha? They are. I would say they are monastics. When you are a Samanera, Samaneri, you are have given up money. And giving up money, I think, is one of the things that really make you into a monastic, because you then become completely dependent on other people's generosity to keep you alive. And that is, one of the perhaps main things about being a monastic, is that giving up of money. So I would say that they are kind of on the edge between Sangha and lay. It's very hard to say exactly what they are. In some ways, they are not Sangha. For example, in the monastic Sangha, we make decisions about all kinds of things. And the Samaneras are not part of the decision-making of the Sangha. For example, if we have an ordination, we're going to decide who is going to be ordained. Then the Samaneras don't actually have a vote. Don't have a say in who gets ordained, for example. So they are, in a sense, monastic, but they're not full members of the Sangha, you could say. So it's a little bit of a halfway house there, but closer to Sangha than to lay people. Okay. Okay, how do I stop the thinking mind? Thank you. Ooh. Okay, so this can be frustrating with the thinking mind. So one of the things you have to do, again, just I already spoke about this, you have to be very patient with yourself. And you have to know that these are habits, very strong habits we have very often. And with very strong habits, it takes a long time to decondition yourself. And it can be quite hard. And it may not happen sometimes during a single retreat that you're able to decondition yourself fully. Sometimes you can expect quite a bit of thinking during a retreat. But if you get a few meditations where you are feeling peaceful, that was already very, very valuable. So don't try too much. So trying is often itself the obstacle. You try to stop the thinking mind. What instead you should do is try to take a step back. Yeah, imagine yourself, you are in the middle of the thinking. So instead of being in the middle of the thinking, you take a step back. So you observe the thinking rather than being in the middle of it. That's quite different. When you are in the middle of thinking, it's like being in the middle of a river. You're trying to swim and you're drowning at the same time. In this case, you're standing back on the bank and you're watching the river pass by. So take a step back. See if you're able to do that. So you're kind of enlarging your scope for what you are seeing and what you're watching. And if you're able to be mindful of your thinking mind, what you will find is that the thinking starts to calm down very quickly. It's as if the thinking cannot stand the mindfulness. The mindfulness kind of automatically makes things calm down. So take a step back, but don't take a step back using too much willpower. Try to take a step back and just allow everything to be. Remember the idea of the coming back home after a long day. You're really tired and exhausted. You sit back and just allow things to be. You don't try to control your mind when you're really tired. You allow the mind to flow. In the same way, in meditation practice, allow the mind to flow. Don't try to control it. And it's interesting, when you don't control the mind starts to calm down. It is the controlling that gives rise to the thinking mind in the first place. The reason why you think is because you want to think, because you are creating the thoughts, you are creating all of these things happening inside of you. So by being passive, you're doing exactly the opposite. Passivity means not creating, not building things up. And because you're not creating and building, the mind starts to calm down. So allow things to be here. Stand back. Try to watch what is going on. And suddenly, and gradually, it will come together. Remember, these are very strong habits. It takes a long time very often for the mind to calm down and to kind of readjust to the new reality. Again, it's about priorities. Remember to prioritize the spiritual life. Remember that the world outside, there is no true goals or purpose or anything in that world. The real goals and purposes are found on the spiritual path. Try to think, see if you can think like that. It may not be easy, but it's a very valuable way of thinking because it takes away the importance of the world and then it takes away the importance of thinking about that world as well at the same time. Okay, good luck here. See what happens. Okay, I understand that the 37 factors or aids to awakening are interrelated. However, I find that the three repeated factors are most sati, effort, and wisdom, and not really sati, effort, and samadhi. Could you please explain, Ajahn? Thank you. Well, samadhi is if you look up all these factors, and you look at samadhi, for example, samadhi is found on the Noble Eightfold Path. Samadhi is found in the five indriyas and the five balas, the five faculties and the five powers. Samadhi is found in the bhujangas. If you look at the bhujangas, they have the samadhi bhujanga and also the upeka bhujanga. Both of those are about samadhi. There you have five already. And then if you go to the four idipadas, the four foundations for spiritual power, that they are really all about samadhi. So another four factors of samadhi right there. That's nine altogether. So if you start counting, you get a lot. Then if you look at sati, it's in a similar kind of thing. You find sati in the Noble Eightfold Path. You find sati in the indriyas, in the balas, that's three. You find sati in the bhujangas, the factors of awakening. The two first are really about sati, that's five. And you have the four satipatthanas, nine. Nine once more. Right effort, similar kind of thing. Noble Eightfold Path, five indriyas, five balas, and then you have the energy in the bhujangas. It's similar to effort, that's four. Then you have the four right efforts, that's eight. So eight times the right effort. That's a lot, yeah, for each one of those. And that's why I say they're very predominant. Then if you go to wisdom, it's true, there is quite a bit about wisdom as well, because the wisdom factors are certainly with the five indriyas and balas, you have them twice, yeah? And then you have, if you go to the, it depends on how you measure these things, how you look at them. But if you go, so you have them there in the Noble Eightfold Path, you would say that the first one, Samma Ditti, is about wisdom, for sure. Samma Sankappa, is that about wisdom? Maybe. So that's four. Then you have Sadda in the, which is faith normally. Is that about wisdom? Possibly that's about wisdom as well. So that's six times wisdom on the path. Yeah, and then the question is whether Dhammavicaya in the Bhujangas, well, that's also wisdom. But you see, it looks like it is a little bit less. Wisdom faculty is not as important, and it's more diverse in the way it is expressed, very often as faith, for example, or as right view. So it's not as clear-cut that it actually refers to the same thing here. So wisdom is obviously very important on the path, but the idea, the wisdom is more like the result. And because it is the result, it is not as important as a factor of the path. It is the path factors that really are important in Buddhism. That is all about how to develop your mind. And the wisdom more comes as a consequence of all of that. Anyway, that's how it looks to me. So, there you are. Okay, this is a long one. Dear Ajahn, based on the talks today, we must develop a particular type of personality, one based purely on what is positive and wholesome. 99.99% of Buddhists wouldn't even have regular jhanas. That's exactly right. Maybe even 99.999, I'm not sure. Not sure how many nines there, but quite a few nines after the comma. Let alone stages of awakening, yet we often tend to use the reflection on anatta as if we know what it means. Based on the Anguttara Nikaya Sutta about the two powers, such reflection which you talked about is good. But we grasp anatta in a way that ignores the fact that we do have a sense of self still. But it would seem that we need to utilize the sense of self as it's what we have to work with in order to move towards wholesome and more useful personality that can easily meditate. Yes, you don't really have much choice. You have to use the sense of self because the sense of self is really what it will always be there. So you don't really have any choice but to use it. That's quite right. So what you do is you can use the anatta reflection, but you have to use it in very specific ways. And it's never going to be 100% successful. And the reason why it's not going to be 100% successful is because there will always be a residue of sense of self inside of you. That doesn't matter. Yeah, it's not about eliminating it completely. It's about reducing it. That's really the purpose of this path. So if you can reduce the sense of self and move towards these kind of qualities, move towards stream entry or whatever it is, that is what is important. Yeah, there's a vast difference between having a big ego and having someone who enters a peaceful state of meditation. It's a big, big difference there. So if we can reduce the ego a little bit, reduce the sense of self a little bit, one of the difficulties with the thinking mind and why the mind is so restless is because we identify with doing. Yeah, we are the doers. We believe that we are the agents in our life. And when someone tells you just to be peaceful and calm and just observe, you are undermining that sense of self. Because that sense of self wants to do. You feel that you are expressing yourself. You feel you are alive. You are indulging that feeling inside of you that you exist. And that is why it is hard to give it up. So by reducing the sense of self, you can become more peaceful in your meditation practice. So it's really about reducing it, not about eliminating it altogether. And you can also use it, as I mentioned before, in regard to things to overcome anger and ill will or irritation, especially if you are upset by people around you. That's where we usually get upset, is in regard to other people. And just remember that people are like robots, basically. We do things because of cause and conditions. It can be quite hard to see this fully, because it feels like we are independent agents in our life, and because it feels like you are an independent agent, it is very hard to see that 100%, but you can get there to a large extent. I have used this to great effect in my monastic life, and it has made me a much less angry person than I used to be. It is a very powerful technique to kind of overcome. It makes it so easy to forgive people for their silliness and their bad precepts or whatever it is that they get wrong here, because you understand they're acting out of conditions rather than acting out of some kind of free will. I'm going to be bad. I'm going to do bad things because that's who I am, and I want to be bad towards this person. It's not really like that. It's more like everyone, I think, ultimately wants to be kind. We want to be kind because we know that kindness is virtually equivalent to happiness. That's what we want to be, but very often we can't stop ourselves from doing doing bad things. And once you get that, then it is much easier to forgive. If you know that the people around you really want to be kind, they really want to be nice, but they can't stop themselves from doing bad, then you can even have compassion towards them when they do stupid things. Because you know they don't understand their own best interest. And in this way, you can use the anatta sanya in a very practical way to overcome your own defilements. Okay, I hope that helps. So try it out and see what happens. Ajahn, I have a problem with sexual desire, and I think it comes from wanting to be wanted, a sense of acceptance. The practice of reflecting on the loathsomeness of the body doesn't really work for me either. It is like a faith logic thing which I cannot reconcile in the physical need of human. Please advise me how I can practice celibacy, which I really think will be helpful for the spiritual path. Thank you. One of the great ways of thinking about of living the spiritual life is just to understand all the problems in the sensual realm. To kind of abandon this whole sensual realm a little bit, understanding that ultimately it is always going to let you down whenever you attach to something, whenever you desire something. It will always lead to problems in the long run. It will always be hard. It will always kind of lead to suffering and problems. The world is always going to let you down. And it's very easy to see that. You know, whenever you kind of turn on the TV, perhaps, or you read the news in a newspaper or something, it is very hard to kind of see the whole of the news section on TV without something upsetting you. Because there's so much stuff in the world which is upsetting. People killing each other, and people going to war, and terrorist attacks happening, and all kind of crazy things. There's so much upsetting stuff happening. And this is always the same thing. It is the world letting you down. It is the five senses letting you down, because all of that is in the world of the five senses. That world is so inherently unsatisfactory. And all of these desires that you're talking about here, they exist in that particular world. And the more you attach to that, the more attached you are to the five sense world in general. So withdraw from all that. We understand clearly why that world is so incredibly unsatisfactory. Understand how you cannot control it, how it's always going to let you down and it's going to let you down pretty much continuously, and it's going to let you down big time when eventually you die. Do you really want to hang out in that world which always lets you down? Do you want all that suffering, all those problems? Yes, you may get a little bit of pleasure here and there, but is it really worth it? And the answer is no. And I'm going to talk more about the problems of the sensory world later on. There is one of my favorite suttas. It's called the Potalya Sutta, Majjhima 54, I think it is. It's a great sutta to how to deal with the whole sensory world, and how to see it and how to understand it. It is far more powerful way of dealing with this problem, I think, than dealing with using the 31 parts of the body, the loathsomeness meditation and all of that. Because very often what happens, if you try to use the 31 parts of the body, depending on what kind of lifestyle you live, it will kind of butt up, the desires would butt up against the meditation subject. And if you live an ordinary life, the desire is always going to win out. Why? Because the desire is considered pleasant, whereas, of course, seeing the body as something neutral or even loathsome, if you wish, is going to be far more unpleasant for you. So the desire is going to win out, and then it is really a hopeless task, two things kind of crashing in that sense. So find the broader view of things, understand the whole world as something that is not really happy. The true refuge is found inside, in meditation practice, by letting that entire world go. And if you do that, then gradually you will overcome this. Also, one of the ways of overcoming these kind of desires is to actually do more metta practice. A lot of desire arises because of actually we're not really happy in this life, and especially if you do the loathsomeness meditation, you may feel really kind of grumpy afterwards and negative because it kind of goes against your other defilements. Yeah, and then if you feel grumpy and negative, you're going to be attracted to the desires again. You're going to want to go exactly the same place because that's the only escape you have. Yeah, that's what the Buddha says. The only escape from suffering that ordinary people know is sensuality. So if you suffer, you're going to go to sensualities. If you do the loathsomeness meditation and then you suffer, bang, straight back to sensuality again. So it's kind of, there's a lose-lose situation. You lose out on all fronts if you do it that way. So instead, develop the metta meditation. Develop something positive inside of you where you reduce the suffering in your life. The less suffering you have in your life, the less interested you're going to be in the sensual realm, because you already have happiness. You don't need to escape into sensuality because you have happiness somewhere else. So develop the other happinesses instead. Be kind. Be generous. Have metta for people in your daily life. Treat people well by body, by speech, by the way you think. And as you develop the inner happiness, the sensuality will gradually decrease because actually it doesn't matter so much anymore. Interesting, the Buddha says that specifically the escape for ordinary people from suffering is sensuality. That's the escape. But the escape for the noble ones from suffering is basically samadhi or jhanas or whatever deep states of meditation you have. Okay, remember it's a long-term problem to overcome. You're going to have to work on it for a long time, and as you work on it for a long time, gradually you will be able to deal with it and overcome this. Okay, please explain, what is nimitta? I often see beautiful lights. Is this part of nimitta? Also, what is the difference between nimitta and jhana? Thank you. Okay, I often see beautiful lights. Is this a nimitta? Possibly, yeah. The word nimitta just means like a mark or a sign or something like that. It can also mean a subject of meditation. We'll have a look at that tomorrow, see how the word nimitta is actually used in the suttas. In the present day, the word nimitta is used, it's often used to any kind of visual thing that you have in your meditation practice. So if you see some interesting things in a meditation, I don't know if you see something interesting, but some people see all kind of stuff in the meditation, like ghosts and devas and all kind of things. That is often also called nimittas. But the kind of nimitta that you want to use for your meditation to gain samadhi is, like you say here, a beautiful light. Yeah, if you actually see that, it means that quite possibly it is the kind of nimitta that it will take you into samadhi. The more beautiful the light is, the more brilliant it is, the more still it is, and all of these things, the more power it has to draw you into a samadhi experience. It sounds to me like you are on the right path with that. If it is beautiful, peaceful, and you feel content and happy and all of that, then it's probably something very good happening for you. What is the difference between nimitta and jhana? The difference is that nimitta is a preliminary stage, and jhanas then come as you keep on developing the nimitta, there comes a point when you enter the jhana. Yeah, it's a kind of further development of the nimitta when you kind of merge with the nimitta or some perception like that. That is really the jhana state. So it is like you brighten up the nimitta more and more and more and more, make it more and more powerful. Keep on going with the nimitta until one day, bang, the world comes to an end. Lokanta, not the Lokanta Vihara, but the real Lokanta of the suttas. Is that Venerable Kalika? It's one of the meaning. Venerable Kalika, he lives in a monastery called Lokanta Vihara, which means the monastery at the end of the world. And the end of the world is kind of interesting. I'm sure that there's many, many meanings to this. And I'm sure, it's Adna Sujata's name, isn't it? His idea. And the idea, I think one of the nice ideas of Lokanta is that the jhanas, they are at the end of the world. So only you have to be willing to give up the world, yeah, to enter the jhana state. So are you ready for that? Are you sure? If not ready, then you have to kind of think about it and reflect on it. And then when you're ready, bam, you go into jhanas. So this is one of the reasons why it is so useful to reflect on the limitations of the ordinary world. Because what we mean very often is meant by the world in the suttas is the world of the five senses. That is the Lokanta, the end of the world of the five senses. And that's where you enter these jhana realms. Anyway. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thank you for having me kindly teach us the method for walking meditation, please. Thank you. Okay. I didn't know I was having you. Are you here? I guess you must be here. So, good. Teach us the method for walking meditation, please. Okay. So, walking meditation can be done in many different ways, but the basic setup is always the same. The setup is to have like a path, a piece of ground that is fairly straight, and there is no obstacles. You can just walk back and forth. You don't have to think about where you're going. So maybe 20, 30 paces, something like that. Yeah. There's no kind of given in the suttas. All it says that the monks or the Buddha is walking back and forth. It doesn't say anything about how they do it. There's nothing given about walking meditation in the suttas. So it's really up to you. Whatever feels natural. But 20, 30 steps is kind of a normal length. Yeah. And you walk along, come to the end, walk back. Yeah. Back and forth. And when you do the walking meditation, I would recommend you to walk at a natural pace. I'm following the way Ajahn Brahm teaches walking meditation, and I think it is quite nice. And the idea is if it is natural, you don't use any willpower. If you try to walk either very fast or very slow, actually very fast is even worse, I wouldn't recommend that at all. But even if you try to walk deliberately slowly, it means that you are forcing the mind to some extent. And always when you force the mind, you very often end up becoming tired because of that. It tires the mind out because the willpower is what tires the mind in general. So don't force too much. Allow things to be as natural as they possibly can. And when it is natural, then the mind is at ease. The mind relaxes. And when the mind relaxes and at ease, you feel good about what you're doing. And that is usually where the mindfulness tends to arise. So walk at a natural pace is my recommendation. You don't have to follow what I say. Just really can do whatever you want. This is just what I would suggest. And then the question is, what do you focus on when you do this? And that really depends on what you want to get out of the meditation session. So, for example, if you want to do more samatha on the walking path, and it's quite possible to do samatha meditation, even get samadhi on the walking path, then often the best way to do that is just to focus on your feet. Focus on your feet as you're moving. Yeah, feel the movement of the foot as you're rising up. The more you can feel of the movement of your feet, the more samadhi you have. It's very similar to watching the breath. The more you can see of the breath, the more stillness you have in your meditation. The more you can feel the movement of your feet, the more stillness you have in your walking meditation. So try to feel everything and see what happens. Yeah, and then as you move, it's possible to become incredibly still by doing walking meditation. But it may be that after you've been sitting in here very often, when we sit a lot, when we do walking meditation, we need to do something else. Yeah, otherwise you can only do so much samatha during the day. I wouldn't recommend doing too much because again, often you have to force the mind if you do too much. So find that nice balance. See what you need. See what comes fairly naturally without using too much force. So another thing you can do when doing walking meditation is contemplate something. Yeah, you can contemplate what we've been talking about. You can contemplate the idea that the five sense world is impermanent, unreliable, out of control, and see what that makes it, what that feels like. You can do a death contemplation, which is very similar. What does it mean that I'm going to die? What does it feel like? You can even visualize yourself as being on your deathbed, because you don't know when it's going to happen. It could happen now. Am I ready to die? What does that feel like? If you're ready to die now, what does that feel like to be ready to die? So you can do a death contemplation. You can do metta meditation while you're walking. You can overcome maybe some of the, if you have some negativity towards some people, you can overcome that. And then you can do some metta meditation afterwards. All of these things you can do. What you can also do, sometimes you can just walk back and forth without having any kind of object as such, and just allow the mind to be, and just observe what is happening in your mind. That can also be very useful. When you do that, when you just observe the mind, you allow the mind to be, you often understand what the problems are, what are the things you need to overcome. And then when the problems arise, you use the methods of reflection to overcome those problems. In a sense, you are purifying yourself. Yeah, that's what you're doing in this way. Seeing what's happening in the mind, you see maybe you are upset about something, and then you forgive that person, whoever that might be. Or you have some kind of desire, and you use some kind of reflection to overcome the desire. And in this way, you're purifying the mind. So after the walking meditation, you feel more peaceful. You come back in here, and you watch the breath again. And if you've got it right, the breath meditation is going to be easier as a consequence. So all of these things are ways of doing walking meditation. If you really want to just relax, you can just go for a walk. Yeah, it's beautiful to go for a walk around here, and you can walk really far if you want to. Yeah, you can cross the boundary and walk into the state forest, and you can kind of get lost, and we will never see you again. And you disappear into the forest, and you become a hermit for life. That's it. Now we will, and you kind of send us a text message. You will tell us where you are, and we'll build a cutie for you there somewhere, wherever you are, and you become a hermit in the forest. Is that a good idea? Sounds quite nice, doesn't it? Yeah, especially towards the end of the retreat when you really kind of got your act together, and then you kind of just walk off into the forest like one of these kind of ancient forest monks or whatever it is. Kind of a nice idea, just disappear into the forest. There are some monks who live like that, and it's actually very inspiring when people do that. They just disappear into the forest. You don't see them for a whole year, and then they kind of come out of the forest after a year. And then they look as if they've been living in the forest for a year. They look really rough and really kind of look like some of these old ancient arahants or whatever, what you might imagine they might look like. But use the property here. Use the path, use the forest. It's so beautiful to be in the forest sometimes. The forest on this property is very kind of civilized. Yeah, the kangaroos are quite civilized here and quite friendly. And the snakes are quite civilized. They usually don't bite you at all. They'll have to be afraid of the snakes. Yeah, usually snakes are far more afraid of you than you are of them. I haven't actually seen any snakes this year, so I don't think you have to be too concerned about it. Enjoy what is here. That is another way of just doing walking meditation, just wander around a little bit. Not really walking meditation, but just enjoying yourself. Okay. Next one. Dear Ajahn Ramali, can you please lead us in a death contemplation? 2 years ago you took us on an amazing journey, what sadly wasn't recorded as part of the retreat. You took us into a complete white room, and from there let us get a go of everything. Thank you. Sure, we can do that, but maybe a little bit later on the retreat. We'll allow kind of the meditation to sink in slowly, and then kind of make you ready for the death contemplation, so that otherwise if you get the death contemplation straight away, and then you might kind of, I don't know, maybe you might leave the retreat or something. So you want to make sure you get at least something out of it before you leave. We don't kind of scare you too much. Actually, it is not very scary scary at all. Death contemplation, if you get it right, is actually quite nice. You really feel quite relaxed about it, because it really is a letting go kind of meditation. The idea of death is a powerful moment to let go, and that is really the idea behind that. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, nowadays memorizing is not part of our education system. Do you think it may contribute to our increasingly scattered minds? Do you think memorizing suttas especially is a good technique for developing samadhi with metta? Maybe. I think the most important thing for samadhi is enjoying whatever you're doing. That is the most important thing for samadhi. So if you really enjoy memorizing suttas, and you think that's a wonderful thing, chances are you will be able to do it, and your samadhi will come as a consequence. So it's really about enjoying what you're doing. It is that across the board. So whatever you are, whatever it is, wherever you want to find that samadhi, if you enjoy the object, if you enjoy the breath, if you enjoy the walking meditation, if you enjoy reading a book, yeah, whatever it is, then the samadhi will arise as a consequence. It is also true, of course, that a lot of the way we live now is actually bad for samadhi. There is so much scatteredness of the mind very often. You are, especially when you are on this, what's it called? All of these things that you find on the internet, Facebook or whatever it is, social media, whatever it is. Of course, it can lead to a lot of scatteredness as a consequence. It's good that we have banned mobile phones here at this retreat center. Is really good. Is it banned? Is that true? Yeah? I don't know. Did anyone say anything about banning them? I don't see anyone with mobile phones. That's a very good sign. Sometimes we go on retreats and people still have their mobile phones, even on retreats. It's good that we don't have that here. It's a very, very positive thing here. So, of course, all of that can often lead to scatteredness and can make you very kind of hyperactive and have attention deficit and all these kind of things. Leaving those things aside, I think reducing your use of social media probably is a very important thing. Deleting your Facebook account probably is going to have a very positive contribution to your practice of meditation. It may have, because it often leads to so much trouble and so many problems. So it is really about enjoying what you're doing. That's where samadhi comes in. So it doesn't matter so much what you do. Learning things by... Sorry? What if you enjoy Facebook? Yeah. Well, so if you... And it's like saying, what if you enjoy sensual desires? Yeah, it's the same kind of thing. Yeah? So you enjoy sensual desires. It's called Miccha Samadhi. Samadhi is the wrong kind of samadhi. Samadhi in the wrong place. It's not going to lead to real stillness of mind as you want through this. So it's about enjoying in the right way, enjoying in terms of spiritual happiness. Okay, Ajahn, the sutta number for the four powers is wrong. It should be 51.13, not 52.13, for your information. I think that's correct, actually, because I've done some of these suttas before, so that is correct. So there's one sutta for the four powers, which is 52.13. It should be 51.13, Sanyutta Nikaya. So I'll mention that when I get to it again. Okay. The last one for tonight. Venerable Sir, how do you develop wisdom to overcome defilement? Where does the wisdom come from? Thank you. That's a very good question, especially if there is no self. Where does the wisdom come from? The answer is, the wisdom comes from the Buddha. Yeah, that's where the initial wisdom always arises from. And it's interesting, one of the suttas that I often have read out on these retreats, it talks about how liberation of the mind happens. How you actually reach arahantship, how you get to the highest stages of the path. It starts off with the Kalyanamitta, or the Sapurisa, the true, the spiritual friend, and the kind of the noble people. Hanging out with them, by being with them, by listening to them, listening to the Dhamma, then you hear the real Dhamma. When you hear the real Dhamma, and you stay with people who are superior people, if you like, in terms of morality, whatever, you gain faith. And when you gain faith or confidence in these teachings, then you have, it says, yoniso manasikara. Yoniso manasikara is precisely applying the mind in the right way. Yeah, so when you talk about using wisdom to overcome defilements, that is exactly what yoniso manasikara is about. And as you can see, initially, it comes from the suttas. It comes from faith and confidence in the Buddha's teachings. So the Buddha tells you that this is how you look at things. Yeah, this is how you think about things. And then you look at that and you think, yeah, that makes good sense. And then you try it out for yourself. You try to use the yoniso manasikara as the Buddha lays it down. And then you start thinking in the right way. And as you do that, as you start to overcome the defilements, your own mind becomes more peaceful, your own mind becomes more able to see these things directly. And when you see these things directly, what was originally the Buddha's wisdom, after a while it becomes your wisdom, because you understand what is going on. So gradually, you take it from the Buddha first of all. This is why the Buddha is so necessary in the world. He is the eye of the world, who sees things for what they actually are. And then you move from that and make it your own wisdom, gradually, 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 as you practice this path. That's how it starts out. Okay, that is all for tonight. Okay, so have a nice night, have a good night's rest, and then we'll see you back again tomorrow morning at 6 a.m.